Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
It's easier actually to look at the Midwestern states that did not achieve double-digit planting progress during the week. That list includes Minnesota, where 9% of the crop was planted, North Dakota, 8% planted during the week, and Missouri, 3% planted during the week.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey on soybean planting progress.
In Missouri, the advance was from just 25 to 28%, staying ahead of the five-year average of 20%. As we move up to the north and looking at Minnesota, that nine-point jump to 22% planted stays ahead of the five-year average of 20%. And in North Dakota, 8% planting progress for soybeans from 2 to 10%. But even there, that's ahead of the five-year average of 2%. So even our slower planted states staying ahead of the respective five-year averages, and that is reflected, of course, in the national numbers.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Obviously, our farmers and ranchers cross country are dealing with a lot of challenges right now. They always deal with challenges, whether it's markets, whether it's prices, and certainly always the weather.
North Dakota Senator John Hoeven at a Senate subcommittee on ag appropriations.
It's vitally important that we do a good job for them in our farm program, but also in the things that we do here in the Ag Appropriations Committee, as well as the countercyclical safety net and the other things that we think of, crop insurance, that our farmers and ranchers need every day to stay in business. Mm-hmm. And we can't, as you and I've talked about before, we have in agriculture about 16 million people that work either directly or indirectly in agriculture. We have a system of small businesses out there in farming and ranching, family-based small businesses that produce the highest quality, lowest cost food supply in the world that benefits every single American every single day. And we as Americans spend less on our food and have the best food and the best choice. And we spend less as a percent of our budget than pretty much any developed country in the world, brought to us by our family farms and ranches. And that we can't take that for granted.
Yeah.
There's so much concentration in so many industries. We have to recognize that it's not by accident that we have this great system. And so good farm policy is so important to keeping that, and it benefits every single American.
Says research and technology have transformed ag.
You were out in our state. You saw North Dakota State University and the incredible work that our land-grant universities do, like A&M and many others. But you also got to see the amazing new technology that's coming with precision ag. Grand Farm example that we showed you out there of really leading the world with precision agriculture, as well as the research and so forth that's being done in Canada with land-grant universities through NIFA, ARS, your research function, and our farmers and ranchers, which has revolutionized agriculture. When I grew up in western North Dakota, we could grow a couple of row crops. Yeah. Now our state grows 40 different crops, and we lead the country in about 15 of them, which we try to rub into South Dakota as often as we can, because they do great stuff too. And we appreciate all of our ag states very much. So again, that's what we're talking about here today. And so the funding for these programs, when we talk to you about FSA and all these things, out on the ground, we've got to make sure we're getting it done for our farmers and our ranchers every single day. So we want to find savings. We want to work with you to find savings, but we got to know that we're still going to deliver that service that keeps those family businesses, those farms and ranchers going every single day to the benefit of every single American.
Mississippi Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith.
Congress needs to address the outdated and inadequate safety nets that is in the farm bill during the budget reconciliation process. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of farmers in Mississippi and across this country that are not going to be able to continue unless we do address this. It is so concerning for me. And addressing one aspect of the farm bill SNAP in reconciliation without making improvements to the farm safety net, it will make it extremely difficult to pass a farm bill. Mm-hmm. But it is so critical. So American farmers, as you well know, desperately want a new and improved farm bill. And I think it's our job to improve the farm bill. So let's give that to them by addressing the safety net and reconciliation. I can't scream that enough. And like I said, I know this is about the budget, but that is so critically important that we do this now.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Net farm income is going up.
Alejandro Plastina is director of the Rural and Farm Finance Policy Center at the University of Missouri.
There's liquidity, hopefully there's profitability, and farmers can support their operations, farmers and ranchers can support their operations in 2025 with this extra liquidity. The concerning part of this spike is the drop that could happen in 2026 if no other source of payments is activated going into 2026. And that's what FAPRI and RAF actually expect, that currently there's no indication that another major set of ad hoc one-time programs will come online in 2026. And that, of course, will bring us back to the downward trend in profit margins in the ag sector.
Brad Lubens, an ag economist, University of Nebraska, Lincoln.
This is looking at the sort of entirety of the farm program payment portfolio, except for crop insurance. Crop insurance is another important part of the safety net and substantial federal support, but that's not paid directly from the government to the producer, so it doesn't show up in their statistics the same way. If you look at these payments from the government to producers, we have near record levels of projected payments here in 2025, second only to the COVID highs of 2020. Nationally, that number would even show that 2025 projected payments are higher than the heights of the COVID era payments in 2020. In Nebraska, not quite as much based on our projections. But it fundamentally does point to some of the challenges of projecting income and projecting your financial position, because this assistance, this supplemental assistance, tends to happen after the fact, and it tends to happen with some uncertainty about when and how it might help out. If you look back in those projections, go back far enough, 25 years or more, you see those supplemental payments showing up in 1999 and 2000 and 2001 and 2002. That was a big bump at the time. That was supplemental payments that helped make up for declining commodity prices amid some losses of Southeast Asian export demand. Those declining prices, those declining economics were met with supplemental payments that helped lead into a farm bill debate in 2002. Then come more recently in the last decade, and you see supplemental payments again show up big in 2018 and 2019. That was the first Trump administration and the trade conflict going on that translated into market facilitation program payments. By 2020, you add in COVID assistance payments and various forms of COVID era relief or supplemental payments. And we set record levels of payments and record levels of payments contributing to farm income. Those have weaned off or waned over time. But here we are again in 2025. Looking at estimates of supplemental payments in the form of the Emergency Crop Assistance Program, and Alejandro pointed to that program, $10 billion nationwide, might be $620 plus million here in Nebraska, and the Ag Disaster Assistance, which is estimated at $21 billion nationwide, but details yet to be determined, so uncertainty in terms of what it may actually bring here to Nebraska. That's the reality. We have relatively strong numbers and farm income projections, but they're also built on some payments that we don't necessarily have much certainty or confidence about looking forward.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Quick note on ARS. While we are decreasing the budget, it's $2.1 billion currently under the president's budget from Friday. It goes down to $1.9 billion. That's about a 7.5% decrease. And that's really focused on just some out of some facilities that are way behind on repair and just out of date and not meeting the mark. Obviously not yours in Nebraska. So that is a very targeted decrease in funding that shouldn't affect. We remain highly, highly focused on the priorities of ARS and ensuring those are funded.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins addressing Nebraska Senator Deb Fischer at a Senate subcommittee Ag Appropriations hearing.
You know, I hope you can also look at that over-regulation that we have with contracting that I mentioned, because a lot of times just those really simple maintenance, it does end up costing more and more and more, where if we can, you know, you always hear about government regulation and how burdensome it is. And there's some good examples that we need to get rid of those good examples and make sure that we're dealing with common sense and in the real world to meet those lower costs that should be available.
And the most important thing you can do is send us, have your team send us those examples, and we'll get on it right away.
Gary Peters is a Democratic senator from Michigan.
As you know, public investment in agricultural research has decreased since 2002. While we've seen competitors such as China surge in their research efforts, they've now far surpassed U.S. investment in agricultural research as well as development. And given the critical importance of food security to national security, China competitiveness in this context, I think, is of much utmost importance for us to keep an eye on. And that's why I'm frustrated to see that the president's budget calls for hefty cuts in ag research funding. So my question for you, Madam Secretary, is ag research a priority for this administration? And if so, how do you square that with this year's budget request?
In the obviously, the research is a key component of this of the work at USDA. In this budget discussion, we're just talking about the discretionary funding, which is about $30 billion of our total $200+ billion annual budget. So, at about 20% total is what we're discussing today. In total, of that, the research part of it in the budget that came out Friday went from $2.1 billion down to $1.9 billion. So while it is a cut, it's not a massive cut. It's a 7% cut, and it's very much focused on outdated facilities. So as we continue the high priority and the focus on the important research, I believe that none of that will be compromised, Senator. If you see something different on the ground in Michigan or across the country, would you please flag it for us? Because it shouldn't affect the key, most important parts of the research.
And another question on research from Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley.
Can you assure us that we're not going to end up without this essential research being done?
Yes, sir. And I really appreciate this question, Senator. So the ARS portion of USDA has a $2.1 billion budget. The president's budget suggests, as you mentioned, the $160 million decrease. That takes us down to 1.9. That's about a 7% decrease. So it's not, you know, as big as maybe it's being made out to be in the press. And that specifically is focused on closing outdated facilities around the country that have nothing to do with the different issues that are being researched that are outlined. So yes, we can commit to ensure that the robust body of research that is so important to our agriculture producers continues.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
I was really deeply concerned when the USDA abruptly cut funding to critical food assistance programs in March.
Ag Secretary Brooke Rollins answering Senator Tammy Baldwin from Wisconsin at a Senate subcommittee on ag appropriations hearing.
Including the local food purchase assistance program and the emergency food assistance program, or TFAP. In 2024, through the TFAP program, Wisconsin distributed over 21 million pounds of food, serving over 618,000 households. Hunger Task Force in Milwaukee had about $615,000 worth of food they expected to help feed people in during this summer, halted by the Trump administration. And Wisconsin farmers and producers work tirelessly to grow food that feeds hungry children and stocks our local food pantries.
So let's talk about that for a second. First of all, those were COVID era programs. They were never meant to go forever and ever. This is part of the problem with, and again, not Democrat or Republican, but any government in general, you put a era program in and then it literally never goes away, which, by the way, is not fair to taxpayers. But let me answer your question directly.
Well, I would also argue that the situation of hunger.
Well, so that's what I was going to, may I respond to that part of it? So specifically to Wisconsin, your program in Wisconsin, aside from what was pulled back, still has $1.2 million left sitting in a bank account out of $8.1 million in your local food purchase assistance program. You also asked your state, not you, Senator, but your state asked for a contract extension because they couldn't spend the money fast enough. Your tribes have 500,000 left out of 700,000
programs because the local food assistance purchase,
that's the LFPA.
That creates opportunities for local farms to produce fresh produce. Some of these others, you know, get canned commodities, et cetera. I've visited several food pantries.
I'm talking about the LFPA
Wisconsin right now.
Center.
And we have 200 to 300 farms that were engaged in this, and this was an expected customer that they no longer have.
But Senator, it was an era, it was a COVID era program that, by the way, you still have millions of dollars left, right, that you can use to pay those farmers. That's the point. Most of that, a lot of that money was never spent. You couldn't spend it fast enough. That's not fair to the taxpayers. Do you know USDA spends $400 million a day on nutrition and food programs, just USDA. That's aside from this food bank. There is plenty of money in the system. We just have to be better about how we're spending it. So I hear you, but I think that it's important to look at where this money is sitting, how it is being spent, and making sure that we're using the taxpayer dollars effectively. But thank you.
Georgia Democratic Senator John Ossoff.
This is a program, of course, that helps Georgia farmers sell food to Georgia schools. Why did you cancel the program?
Well, let's talk about Georgia for a second. The local food.
I have 50 seconds left.
Well, that's a big question. You've got to give me a little bit more time.
You can take it up, but I want to know why you canceled the program.
Well, we canceled the program. It was a COVID era program, first of all. Second of all, the money wasn't being spent. In the current tranche, your state has $2 million of $7 million left in the account. You're asking for contract extensions because you can't spend the money quickly enough. The food for the FPA, the LFPA, we've got $10 million of $20 million left.
Right,
so you've got money in the bank.
It's not a good use of taxpayer funds.
When you've got taxpayer dollars. Well, I would love to talk to your constituents. I wonder if they know that the state of Georgia has not moved that money out.
Will you please provide to the committee an economic justification for the outright cancellation of that program?
An economic justification for the outright cancellation of the COVID era program that was due to end. Yes,
of the local food for schools program that my constituents enjoy and rely on.
Yes, we will be happy to do that, sir.
Thank you, Madam Secretary.
Thank you.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
As we're starting to see cattle weights continue to rise, or at least in some cases plateau week to week, the big impact has been just been grading, primarily on prime cattle.
Elliot Dennis, livestock economist, University of Nebraska at Lincoln, on the industry increasing quality.
Longer days on feed is strongly correlated with higher cattle quality. So we just see a lot more cattle grading in the primary at 12%, and so much to the point that we're looking at the total cattle grading prime and select, and they're almost similar. And so you have a ton of cattle grading, prime and choice now, and select is really becoming a minor kind of category. And I think that it has to do a lot of reasons. Genetic improvements is definitely one of them. So definitely the shout out to the, cow-calf producers who are making that. I think one of the things that's helped that has been genetic testing. Genetic testing and really this focus on, EPDs and improving and putting those into ways to kind of quantify them, like the dollar index and the dollar beef. These types of indices have helped producers also make, better selection decisions. And then, of course, we can't ever ignore the shift into cattle going onto the grid and formula, people actually getting paid for those premiums and discounts. And I think in large part, we talk about genetics, just like we were at the individual animal for animal health, we really switched from pen level to treating individual animals rather than pen level. I think we started to do that also on performance, trying to treat each animal, not pen level performance, but individual animal performance. And I think prior to genetics and using genetics, that has been really hard. How do you, essentially you're feeding an average weight to the pen or average doneness, which means some animals are probably less done and some animals are overdone. That assumes that you're not doing any like terminal sorting at the end. But I think genetics has really helped us kind of fine tune that some animals, to be honest, maybe we're not reaching that genetic potential. And in this cattle market right now, I think we're starting to realize that maybe we were underfeeding cattle pretty significantly. And now that we have kind of production performance with different technologies, like using GrowSafe technology, where we can actually get individual animal feed intake performance, we're able to, have basically optimize each individual animal better. And I think that has resulted in, a stronger, more resilient market.
And he says this could be a quote-unquote fun summer.
the jobs report came out, I think it was a little bit of shock to the market. There's been a lot of negativity in the press about the trade, obviously the Doge and kind of what's been going on. And so the fact that, you know, the jobs report came out and said we added more jobs than expected, I think gave the Friday markets a boost going into the weekend. People starting to question whether this is maybe a little bit overblown or not. Is the economy actually strengthening more than we thought? And really, that kind of clashes a little bit with consumer sentiment, which says, you know, people are being a little bit more pessimistic about where the economy is going. So kind of dual or conflicting kind of signals there, that consumer saying, I'm maybe a little bit more pessimistic, so I may want to ration some of my purchases. But the economy saying, you know, actually more people are getting jobs, which means more money is flowing through the economy. So we have to wait and see kind of how that sorts out through May. Obviously, that has big implications for beef, as it's a premium product and people purchase it. But excited to go into the growing months. Should be a fun summer.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In late March, I wrote you a letter detailing my concerns about USDA's delay in releasing some program funds. Mm-hmm.
Susan Collins, a senator from Maine, at a Senate subcommittee Ag Appropriations hearing with Brooke Rollins, Ag Secretary.
I've heard from constituents who have received grant award letters from USDA in the previous administration, only to later receive letters from USDA informing them that their grant funding is frozen. Now, this is obviously very troubling to them. It creates a lot of uncertainty. And we are a state that has lost 600 farms in the past decade. And that is very troubling to me. I grew up in northern Maine. One of my first jobs was picking potatoes for a farmer. And I am aware of how important that heritage is to our state and to our food supply. So we've seen a situation where farmers, landowners, loggers, natural resource businesses that have applied for USDA loans still have no clarity on what decisions will be made. And the timing of this funding is absolutely critical, mm-hmm. because, as you know well, agricultural producers are making purchases now for this year's crops, and processing facilities need to order equipment for the summer and the fall harvests. Local farm economies are fragile, and timing is really important. So I know and appreciate that you've made some significant strides in releasing program funding over the past few weeks. Could you provide the subcommittee with an update on federal funding at USDA that remains frozen and a timeline for when you plan to finish your reviews?
I will. And I take to heart so sincerely everything you've said. And I know many of you have reached out during this process of frozen funds from both sides of the aisle. And my goal is to respond immediately. Sometimes it's at midnight. Sometimes it's at 5 a.m. But my goal is always to respond and to be available. I have an amazing team. Kaylee Bowler is our chief of staff. She's here. Jen Taylor and a few others that you all probably know well. And we are working around the clock, going line by line by line. We're down to the final $5 billion out of, I believe, almost $20 billion of frozen funds. But $5 billion is a lot of money. And when you think about that in terms of, you know, grant or contract and moving that out quickly, we're very hopeful to keep moving through that very, very quickly and have that done very soon. But what I will say, and you all know this that have worked with me, I am always available. So if there is one or a group in particular that you want us to make sure we're getting to, please just let me know. If I know almost everybody here has my cell phone number, maybe not a few of you, but I'm always available. Several of these guys have it too. So just call me and just know we're doing our very, very, very best. Some of the funding that we have pulled back and then reopened, we've asked for reapplications to realign around this president's priorities, which of course, not surprisingly, is not diversity, equity, and inclusion or some climate programs, but instead to reapply where the farmer rancher would receive 65% of the funding or more. That's another piece of this as well. So we again are going line by line. We're working around the clock, and believe me, we are on it. But please know to always reach out if there's something specific. And I hear you.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Plenty of warm weather around, looking pretty good. 11% of the U.S. corn crop emerged by May 4th, 2 points ahead of the five-year average, right on par with last year. We are starting to see some of that Midwestern corn emerge. No surprise that Missouri leads the Midwest, 31% emerged. Five-year average there, 27%. And just seeing our first 1 or 2 or 3 percentage points emerging during the week in states like Michigan, Minnesota, North Dakota, as well as to the east in Pennsylvania, just starting to see a few fields starting to emerge 1 to 3%.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
Our first look at soybean emergence for the 2025 season, showing 7% of the U.S. soybean crop emerged by May 4th. Five-year average is 5%, just slightly behind last year at this time, 8%. The emergence taking place in the south, leading the nation with emergence on May 4th, is Louisiana, 57%, 20 points ahead of the five-year average. Next on the list is Mississippi, almost half the crop, 48% emerged, well ahead of the five-year average of 34%.